So I'm Mary, and I'll be giving tonight's lecture, which is called Projection, Psychoanalysis of Polanski's Apartment Trilogy. It's a great honor for me to be back at the Freud Museum. I consider it my spiritual home, and always excited to be here. So first, a bit about me. I'm from Montreal, where I took a degree in psychology. I came to London to pursue postgraduate studies in psychoanalysis, which I applied to film. I wrote my MPhil dissertation on Marilyn Monroe, and that work led me to discover the BFI, where I'm now employed. I've developed a lecture series called Projections, based on a term that exists in both psychoanalysis and cinema, and the aim is to explore in an accessible way existing themes and motifs contained in film through Freudian concepts. So tonight, as John said, is the first in a series of films on European filmmakers, starting, of course, with Polanski, and I'll be looking specifically at Repulsion, Rosemary's Baby, and The Tenant. Next month, as was mentioned, we'll be looking at Pasolini's film Theorem, and I'll be comparing that with Luca Guadagnino's film I Am Love. And in June, it'll be the films of Lars von Trier, namely Dogville and Manderley. And this information is available on the Freud Museum website. So if you have any questions or comments while I deliver the talk, please wait to share your thoughts during the final portion of the evening, where I've left some time for discussion. I really do look forward to hearing from you. I have with me some evaluation forms that help me to obtain feedback from the audience as I'm still, as I continue to develop my projections lectures. So it'd be great to obtain any information from you as a listener. And I also have a question there about what films you might be interested to analyze. So do have a think about that, and I'd love to know your thoughts. So finally, our warm thanks to all the staff members at the Freud Museum for once again making me feel so welcome. So to start with, a brief overview of psychoanalysis as the framework for film interpretation. Sigmund Freud was a revolutionary figure in naming the unconscious as the primary motivating agency of the mind. He said that the majority of behavior is irrational and actually a symbol of some unresolved and repressed conflict. The techniques that he was known to use, of course, two very popular ones being free association, where a relaxed subject reports all passing thoughts without reservation. That's very interesting to me from the point of view of analyzing film. I think that's quite essential as a technique in both psychoanalysis and also film interpretation. But also dream analysis, where obviously the focus in the clinical work is to ask the subject to relate their dreams and look principally at the logic of their dream and try and make sense of that. But I think that also is a technique that, you know, purely from a Freudian perspective, if you follow letter by letter what is said, you know, in terms of dream analysis, it's a very useful method for looking at cinema as well. These things are done in order to bring the unconscious into conscious awareness and make it available for interpretation. And the remedy or cure, of course, is trying to piece together seemingly disparate and unrelated material to try and make some sort of sense, see some higher order theme going on where that itself has a remedy for the subject, to try and make sense of these repressed desires. It's very important to say a word about the style of the analyst. It's very much investigative. So in the sense that the analyst is constantly digging away in the unconscious, searching for clues, searching for forgotten, even if seemingly unrelated or irrelevant material, and then piecing it back together to form a cohesive narrative. In the same way, Freud liked to observe that archaeologists have this investigative approach. They will more often than not dig away in the soil, searching for remnants of lost civilizations, unearth them, bring them back from that lost era, and piece that together to form a narrative. The detective functions exactly in the same investigative manner on a crime scene using forensic science to tell a story about what happened moments, if not days or even years before the actual crime take place. And this investigative style is also important as from a film spectator's point of view. Even if it's just purely for light entertainment, just purely for escapism, this film spectator is always investigating to search for meaning in a film. So I think for those reasons, the investigative style is one of many methods why the psychoanalyst position parallels the film spectator position. So many have wondered what the unconscious might actually look like. But because it is by nature unknown to us, we can only speculate about the unconscious via its representation. So what might those be? Well, according to Freud, dreams are the royal road to the unconscious, in the sense that if we want to get a sense about the shape of the unconscious, if we were to even know it in that sense, Freud said that we can look at the texture of dreams, the logic, or maybe lack of logic in dreams, and then we get a clear picture about how the unconscious organizes itself. Freud's successor, Jacques Lacan, the French psychoanalyst, he said it's not so much the dreams exactly that tell us what the unconscious looks like. It's actually a lot more how the patient relates the dream using language, and how we can know about their inner world by examining the way that they relate within language, how they position themselves in the discourse, and how they relate to words. And in that sense, he said, the unconscious is actually structured like a language. But I think that the beauty of cinema is that you can have both. You don't need to compromise, because it is really the intersection of dreams and language. Those two elements are very much alive in the medium of cinema. So you can have both, and it gives you a kind of much more comprehensive dimension to this texture of the unconscious. So throughout the lecture, I'm going to be applying the hydraulic model of the mind to each segment of Polanski's apartment trilogy. Freud was interested in the trajectory of desire, the way in which desire moves around the human psyche. And the term hydraulic relates to the fluid aspect of desire. So sometimes desire is expressed, and other times it's blocked and repressed. But in this model, energy does not merely vanish when its path is blocked. It only transfers onto a new place, often appearing in a disguised form. And so emotional balance and psychological health depend upon the way in which desire is transferred. So I'm sure many of you are familiar with this, but I'll just go through it for the sake of the lecture, for those of us who don't know. So supposing the mind is, divided into two parts, and deep in the sort of recesses of our mind is the unconscious, which is the home of the id, and right at the threshold of awareness is the ego. So below that, just saying some things about the id and the ego. The id being, of course, the primary source of spontaneous psychic energy, demanding to obtain what it wants without delay, operating purely on the pleasure principle, and the ego understanding the limitations of what is possible within the real world, always negotiating and making compromises about what's feasible, operating on the reality principle. So supposing that's the case, then down below, in the realm of the unconscious and the domain of the id, we have all these unspoken desires constantly, propelled to reach the surface of awareness. They're constantly driven in that direction. And sure enough, when a desire reaches the level of conscious awareness, it's possible, it's very, very possible that they will be met with a superego agency, some restrictive, some censoring agency, such as religion, the law, the employers, preventing the expression of the wish, in some form, basically some authority figure, which we call the superego. So what happens there is that, basically that desire will get repressed, but it'll only be repressed momentarily, because that sort of operation of out of sight, out of mind doesn't exist in the hydraulic model. We know very well that all that happens is that the energy just needs to transfer in some other way. So basically, according to the hydraulic model, if the energy gets repressed, that desire will have the motivation to express itself again, but it'll know that it'll need to reinvent itself, disguise itself in some new way in order to escape suppression once again. So it'll come back in the form of perhaps accidents, fantasy, slips of the tongue, psychopathology, and dreams. It's always a mode, a very clever way of returning once again and always striving for that expression, which can be sometimes very elusive. So going straight now into the apartment trilogy, just introducing the titles on the one hand, and then I'll go more deeply into each segment. So we've got Repulsion from 1965, the story of Carol Ledoux, played by Catherine Deneuve, and she's represented as a severely repressed single Belgian woman living in a London apartment with her sister in the swinging 60s. The film shows her descent into homicidal madness, if you remember. Rosemary's Baby, released in 1968, which is the story of Rosemary Woodhouse, played brilliantly by Mia Farrow. She's a married woman living in New York with her husband, where her husband Guy makes a Faustian pact with the neighbors to further his acting career. And I have to say, Rosemary's Baby is probably my favorite one of the trilogy. It's so hammy and yet still so effective as a psychological thriller, so that's quite an achievement. But The Tenant, the final installment in the apartment trilogy from 1976, is a story of a timid bachelor called Trelkovsky, played by Roman Polanski himself. He's a man who moves into a small apartment in Paris, previously occupied by a woman who had committed suicide, and their identities start to blur into one. So these these three films, in these, Polanski portrays fragmented psyches in oppressive spaces, and what connects these characters is a sense of isolation, alienation, and paranoia. Meaning in each installment becomes more enhanced, I think, within the context of a trilogy. At least I thought so, because sometimes, you know, you might watch one of them in isolation, and there's a lot of gaps and a lot of questions, but I find in this little grouping, somehow they all, the meaning just gets more enhanced. So straight into part one, 1965's Repulsion. It's a low-budget British horror film with art house aesthetics. Story of Carol, played by Catherine Deneuve, very shy, childlike, quite absent-minded since a young age. We can deduce that because we see pictures of her in the apartment. You can see that on the left side there, and she looks a bit, you know, sort of preoccupied by something. And throughout the film, we see her, you know, playing with her hair like a child, biting her fingernails, tentatively trying on her older sister Helen's dress, putting on too much, you know, too many sugar cubes in her coffee, that sort of thing. It makes you think that she's quite juvenile in some sense. Her surname is interesting. She's called Carole Ledoux. Ledoux is a French translation which means the soft one. So, of course, if you look at, you know, her, just sort of the way she looks very sweet and lovely blonde hair and very sort of innocent looking, quite naive, very softly spoken. And this is in high contrast, of course, to later on when we actually see her homicidal tendencies and that she can be quite violent. So it's a very interesting choice of a name, I think. And yes, she retreats to the all-female world of the beauty parlor where she works. She overhears their wealthy female clients, and her young colleague Bridget, relentlessly complaining about men, branding all male, you know, males filthy pigs, you know, that sort of thing. You can see that her image of masculinity is very much shaped by what other women around her are saying about men. But equally, her image of masculinity is also shaped by what she witnesses between her sister Helen and her married boyfriend Michael. You know, they're having this kind of illicit affair, and in a sense, I mean, where they live, the walls are quite paper thin, and at night she overhears her sister in throes of passion with her boyfriend, and you know, it's sort of that kind of primal scene situation, you know, the initial witnessing by a child of a sex act that traumatizes their psychosexual development. So that's sort of all happening as well, shaping just her perception of men, and mainly also sex. So yeah, she's extremely repressed, and this whole thing leads to some sort of agoraphobia, or at least a psychosis for sure. So it's important to contextualize repulsion very much in the city where it's all happening at that time in 1965, and that happens to be the swinging 60s in London. So what a contrast again. There's a great explosion going on in terms of culture. It's a whole cultural revolution. London was always looked at that time as where the action was. Musically, everything was going on, the British invasion, Beatlemania, psychedelic rock. Fashion was very much on the up and up in terms of names like Mary Quant becoming household names, the mini skirt being extremely popular with women, and Twiggy, everybody wanted to, you know, wanting to copy her style and her look. It was very much a hip, very youth-orientated sort of scene at the time, with lots of modern values, period of optimism and hedonism, certainly with regards to sex and drugs. So everybody was letting their hair down, everybody was partying. And here we have, you know, little Carol, all of the excitement of the swinging 60s, firmly in contrast to Carol's deep-seated fear of sex and, you know, her shy, retreating nature. It's, again, a very interesting contrast. And the horror, in a way, of the film Repulsion is witnessing the isolation of a young woman who could have the world as her oyster, and yet she just is holed up in the apartment, going mad. Carol gets a lot of unwanted male attention the few times we see her walking along the streets of South Kensington, which makes her feel even more withdrawn and timid. And there's a young man, and he's there in the picture, called Colin, and he pursues her. He seems like a genuinely nice chap, you know, harmless and very respectful, and he's very much interested in her, but Carol doesn't reciprocate at all. One day, he asks her out on a date, and she just, you know, stares blankly at her fish and chips, which she doesn't even touch. There's no real sort of vibe there going in his direction. And one day when he leans in for an innocent kiss on the cheek, she runs away from him. I think she overreacted a little bit. One day she just is holed up in the apartment for days. And when Colin goes to visit her at the apartment, you know, she turns away from him and leaves the front door wide open. And Polanski's camera captures Carol's preoccupation perfectly, in the form of a nosy neighbor eavesdropping on the conversation. This seems like not like a huge thing when you first watch Repulsion, but I think that this is the seed of the apartment trilogy. It's not just that she's repressed. She has this preconceived notion about what the neighbors are going to think about her if she's standing there talking to a man. She probably is projecting her own, you know, discomfort, because she feels uncomfortable late at night when she overhears her sister. She's projecting all this sort of stuff on the neighbor, and what must she be thinking about her? So it's all this sort of, this element of the nosy neighbor really amplifies in the next films and comes to a massive crescendo in The Tenant. So Carol's sister, Helen, she's certainly not immune to fun in the, you know, in London swinging 60s. Helen is having an affair with a married man called Michael, and as I mentioned before, the sounds of their nightly passion contribute to Carol's disturbance. So Helen and Michael decide one day to leave Carol on her own in the apartment for a romantic holiday to visit the Leaning Tower of Pisa. So I don't need to tell, you know, I'm in a room presumably full of Freudians. So I'm sure you probably thought the same thing as me there. You know, obviously the tower can be interpreted as a phallic symbol in Repulsion's narrative, as it is imposing, and it's got that leaning aspect which gives it a certain live, reaching quality. And the leaning element also suggests that there's something awry in the foundations of the building, some sort of structural integrity gone awry, a reflection of something being askew in Carol's mind as well. you know, she's got a kind of leaning psyche. And Carol receives a postcard from the couple, and on the back of the postcard, there's a cheeky kind of flirtation from Michael, advising Carol not to make too much dolce vita while they're away, as if she would. You know, she's very, very well behaved. And Helen informs, you know, that there's a thousand things to tell, which fuels, you know, Carol's repressive imagination even further. So, carrying on with the kind of obvious Freudian stuff here, Carol is fixated on the fact that whenever Michael visits the apartment, he constantly leaves his razor in her bathroom glass. She complains to the sister about it, and she, you know, in repulsion, you know, the razor being placed in the glass can be interpreted as a symbol of sexual intercourse. And even if on the surface, you know, Carol seems to dislike Michael's presence, persistently removing his razor from the glass all the time, you know, we can assume that there exists a certain fascination with Michael as she later keeps his razor disturbingly close to her, even using it as a kind of weapon, you know, for inflicting violence on other people. And the increasing clutter and chaos of the apartment mirrors the state of Carol's mind. The cracks start to form in the walls, there's upturned furniture, sprouting potatoes, you know, this kind of, it's all being neglected in the apartment. And the decaying rabbit, you know, in Repulsion, this conjures up the surrealism of down the rabbit hole in Alice in Wonderland, as well as kind of, you know, the expression going at it like rabbits to represent, you know, her sister's uninhibited sexuality. And the shot of the putrefied rabbit paired with Michael's razor creates this kind of terrifying and destructive image of sexuality contained in Carol's mind. So we know that Carol is a manicurist by profession, you know. She cuts, shapes, and paints fingernails, removes cuticles, softens the skin of her clients' hands at the beauty parlor. So Carol's job is to make hands attractive looking, but Repulsion reveals hands as a nightmarish, invasive force in Carol's psychosis, and the underlying role that hands play in her violent hallucinations. So we've got here that incident at the beauty parlor where, you know, Carol's kind of mindlessly going through the motions of cutting someone's cuticles, and she kind of, you know, maybe accidentally, you know, maybe on purpose, who knows, cuts through the finger, and the poor lady's, you know, horrified, and there's blood trickling down. It's a whole thing. And then, you know, there's another instance where that's the night that Michael visits, and they were supposed to have rabbit at home, and then he kind of just leans in. He invades her personal space, reaches out, grabs her cheek like that, flirts with her. You know, she doesn't like this kind of, you know, touchy-feely stuff, or does she? That's the whole thing about repression, of course. And then, you know, these are quite iconic scenes of her hallucinations in the apartment, where the hands are sprouting out from the corridor walls, groping and molesting her until that final moment. You know, and there, I thought it's kind of a very scary homage to Cocteau's, you know, Beauty and the Beast, with the kind of arms sprouting out of the walls holding the candelabras. That's a lovely image, of course, very different from here, where the arms are sprouting out of the wall to presumably intimidate, you know, make her feel uncomfortable in her own mind. So I'm just going to play a short clip for you from Repulsion, and then we'll just have a look at what might be going on in that little scene there. Just bear with me as I...
Anyway. Sarah. You never give me a chance to show you what a good cook I am.
You're going to tell me over dinner. You think I'd have something better to do than climb away like that all the time?
Miss Weston is down doing it at midnight.
I wonder what they're ringing for anyway. Perhaps they have wild parties. Maybe they'll invite me sometime. Come put your best bib and tucker on. I feel like a spree.
I thought you were eating him. Aren't you going to have dinner? Yes, I'm going to have dinner. But not here.
No,
not here. Just because I go out once, there's no need to start sulking. I'm not sulking. Quite not exactly smiling.
Come on, you're not going into the Miss World competition.
Will we go and see the Leaning Tower of Pisa?
I don't think Cinderella likes me.
Cinderella?
The little sister.
Ach, don't be silly. But are we going to see the Leaning Tower of Pisa?
She's a bit strung up, isn't she?
She's just sensitive, that's all.
Say that again. She should see a doctor.
What do you mean?
Nothing, nothing, nothing.
No, you just tell me what you meant, Arthur.
Well, let's forget it. You want to see the Leaning Tower of Pisa? We'll see the bloody thing. Now let's relax. We're going after dinner.
Don't you always change the subject when you start talking like that?
So yes, just some observations connected to that clip now. So Helen and Michael, you know, we see them together. They're very lively. They share jokes. They fill the apartment with sounds of laughter and banter. It's in high contrast to the silent, preoccupied Carol when they leave the apartment. You know, it's very deliberately filmed in that way, the way that Polanski constructs that film. The high energy, high octane sort of, you know, enthusiasm going on in the first half. And then as soon as they're out the door, it's just this kind of very slow paced, very monotonous, quite dull, sort of, you know, quite boring tasks. I don't know exactly what Carol was, you know, intending to do, but it was just sort of very laborious in a way to watch. It's quite dull, but in a way, it's very brilliantly done, you know, that contrast to show just how incredibly withdrawn Carol is as a person. So the repressive images, of course, of religion make it a complex scene as well, as we see that, you know, Carol's apartment is opposite a nunnery, and the tolling of the convent bell signifies chastity, but comes to bear mixed associations as the sound of the doorbell and telephone later in the film. These bells alert the mans of men, which Carol struggles to cope with. Polanski shows Carol's distorted image reflected in the kettle, of course. This suggests a sort of distorted inner psyche, something that Michael suspects is going on, but Carol is in denial about. So if we were to try and place Carol in the hydraulic model of the mind, I wonder if we could perhaps, you know, think about what that might look like, you know, assuming, of course, that there's that sort of partition between the unconscious and her ego-level sort of awareness. I actually think, I was thinking about it, and I think that the thing that Carol's repressing, is this kind of burgeoning eroticism. The attraction to Colin may be there, the boy who pursues her. I think certainly a sexual curiosity about Michael. And this might be going on, you know, below her threshold of awareness. And if one of the desires makes itself known to her, then of course the tendency is for that sort of super ego authority structure to suppress that, you know, maybe stuff she's been hearing at the salon, you know, opinions about men that might be influencing her. The nosy neighbors, certainly, I think, you know, plays a part in her repression. But also I think that with the proximity with the convent, I think that's quite important there too. And I think that what goes on, of course, is that momentarily that desire will be repressed, but then, of course, it will return again in the form of sexual dysfunction, hallucinations, social anxiety, agoraphobia, psychosis, and, as we later learn, murder. So those things will come to disguise something that initially was actually quite, you know, an innocent burgeoning eroticism. So moving straight on to Rosemary's Baby, released 1968, here the fear of sexual relations from the first installment in Repulsion, this fear graduates to a fear of pregnancy and childbirth in Rosemary's Baby. So there's some of this kind of logical progression in the direction of fear from sex to having a baby. Rosemary's Baby is a screen adaptation of a successful novel by Ira Levin. It was Polanski's first Hollywood film. I don't think it was quite successful for its time. Rosemary, you know, the character being played by Mia Farrow, she's a very trusting character, quite, you know, happy-go-lucky, fragile in some ways, needs protecting, needs guidance, quite earnest, very, you know, people-pleasing character. And she's married to Guy Woodhouse, who's a professional actor. And of course, the name Woodhouse, you know, when I kind of tried to free associate with that, it got me thinking too, okay, you know, solid, reliable, natural home. And then, of course, we realize over the course of the film that that's exactly the opposite of what they create in the apartment in New York. You know, it's a very unreliable, very untrustworthy, paranoia-inviting, and supernatural home, it turns out as well. So quite the opposite there, again, high contrast. And I think And for, this is true for all three films, but I think especially here, the surface of the story is a symbol for some underlying conflict. It's very much the whole, you know, business of dream analysis, where we have the surface events happening on the, you know, what the subject remembers, and that Freud called the manifest content, and of course that really being a disguise for the latent meaning that provoked those images to come into being. So keep, bear that in mind as we go through this portion of the trilogy. So just as it was important in Repulsion to contextualize geographically where those things were happening in the swinging 60s in London, in Rosemary's Baby, the American dream is quite, I think, like a prominent feature, or at least a contributing motif to the story happening in New York. You know, oftentimes, you know, the national ethos of the USA is a kind of land of opportunity, you know, the chance to achieve prosperity, success, and upward mobility through dedicated hard work. That, you know, there's a promise of a better, richer, and fuller life, regardless, you know, of social class and circumstances of birth. You know, and certainly, you know, we've been hearing this past week since, you know, Margaret Thatcher passing away, that that was something that she really espoused in her politics, this whole business of, you know, it doesn't, or at least that's what, that was the promise, but not sure how that, you know, pans out. But ultimately, it's really about if you want it bad enough and you work hard, then you can achieve it. And then this kind of, on the flip side, if taken to its extreme, can become a preoccupation, obsession with materialism at the price of personal relationships, which I think is something, an overarching theme happening here in Rosemary's Baby. So Rosemary, you know, she's a very impressionable, quite easily swayed person when it comes to materialism, this being a sign of her naive and trusting nature rather than any kind of ruthless ambition. So for instance, you know, she beams with pride upon seeing her husband acting in a Yamaha commercial. When she's upset with her husband, for valid reasons, I hasten to add, Rosemary forgives too quickly at receiving several bouquets of flowers from Guy. She chops off her pretty bob in favor of a Vidal Sassoon, you know, radical, ultra-short hairstyle, because she says it's very in, so clearly being very sort of influenced by the marketing campaign for those haircuts. And then, you know, we can conclude really that she's a sort of obedient, you know, daughter of consumer culture and is seduced by the pretty piece of jewelry gifted by the manipulative neighbor, Mrs. Castavet, and the attractive pendant, you know, covering up a harmful poison, becomes some sort of allegory for capitalism itself. Let's spend some time talking about Guy, though, the husband, because you know, he doesn't appear that much in the film. He's in some very prominent scenes, and it's easy to think of him as just, you know, some sort of nothing more than a support character. But I actually think he's a driving force in how the underlying narrative of the film is shaped. Guy's a very ambitious, you know, man. He's quite vain and insensitive, and I would say also selfish. I'm not his biggest fan. He has, you know, materialistic aspirations and a win-at-all-costs attitude when it comes to his acting career. You know, a kind of exaggeration of the sort of, you know, the spirit of the American dream when it comes to business and enterprise. Upon first meeting his neighbors, the Castavets, Guy is uninterested in them until he learns that he stands to gain professionally from associating himself with the elderly couple. You know, Roman Castavet compliments Guy on his acting, claiming he has an interesting inner quality and that it should take him a long way provided he gets those initial breaks. You know, and this could refer to sort of the breaks that he's talking about. It could be breaking marriage vows, breaking moral codes. You know, this can be seen as a metaphor for the greed and corruption which can take place in this sort of consumer-obsessed system. And, you know, when I was free associating with the word cast of it, it made me think of the Hollywood casting couch. And in this scene here where Guy is effectively being auditioned for his role in the Faustian Pact, we can kind of think of that almost as a casting couch audition or something. And Castavet also sounds like, which is casting a spell on Rosemary, which is what happens in the film. But I think the real trauma is that Guy is capable of loyalty, but not to Rosemary. Guy is only faithful to his professional progress and intends to advance by any means necessary, even using his wife in a plot to deliver Satan's baby, which is, that's quite a dedication. So anyway, as soon as, you know, Rosemary and Guy move into their new apartment, the young wife puts all her efforts into redecorating their new home. And Rosemary paints over all the imperfections of the apartment, getting rid of all the unsettling traces of the late former tenant, Mrs. Gardenia, adding furniture, new, beautiful, fresh, modern look. But let's suppose that the apartment is the residence of Rosemary's ego, you know, in the hydraulic model of the mind. She might want to present her public image as, you know, through the apartment, as being a happy, optimistic young wife, creating a perfect space for the family she plans to have with her husband. And he's so lovely, he's so sweet with her, he sends her flowers. You know, this is kind of the public facade, the ego domain, which Freud was, you know, talking about in the hydraulic model. She's quick to tidy up any mess of unresolved conflict and, you know, that hidden closet, the pathway to her repressed unconscious, you know, that sort of portal to the closet that's adjacent to the cast of this apartment. That's all covered up. It's freshly sort of covered up with paint and pretty gingham paper. And the renovation process symbolizes the ego's sanitization and the censorship of an underlying conflict to maintain a public facade of marital bliss, totally covering up, you know, the hollow relationship she really does have with her selfish and caring husband, Guy. So really, the tragedy is that even after all the apartment renovations, the repressed still returns to haunt Rosemary, and she quickly learns that the ego is not the master of his own house, just like Freud famously, you know, stated. There are all kinds of signs that Rosemary's having a pregnancy from hell. The date of her baby's conception is planned for a birth in June 1966, which, you know, in numerological terms, it represents 666. Her food cravings are disturbing, such as the scene where she impulsively gorges on raw liver and then becomes sick when she realizes what she's actually eaten. Rosemary's doctor, you know, orders her to drink bizarre smoothies prepared by Mrs. Castevet, but she suspects these could be poisoning her. And instead of gaining weight, she becomes emaciated and looks too pale. Her friends remark that she looks like a piece of chalk. So the underlying fear, I think, though, is that if you examine that as just being the manifest content, those scenes just appearing on the surface, I think the underlying fear for Rosemary is of a lifelong bond with a husband she doesn't respect. The unspeakable repressed terror is Rosemary's hatred of Guy and the fact that she doesn't trust him. These are things she can't admit to herself. So in this context, the unborn child symbolizes some kind of like hideous monster, you know, monstrous entity that's going to be uniting her with Guy forever. And a baby, you know, from hell in this case represents actually the marriage from hell. So I'm just gonna play a clip from Rosemary's Baby. I don't know how many of you have seen the film, but it's what I think is probably one of the best dream sequences in film ever. So let's play that now.
Great spot for my Yamaha commercial.
Real charmer guy, isn't he? Okay, let's see. So just kind of looking at that clip, just some observations from what we've watched. So we hear Guy exclaiming, you know, at the beginning that the TV coverage of the Pope at Yankee Stadium is a great spot for his Yamaha commercial, you know, pointing again to his obsession with his career. And at the start of Rosemary's dream sequence, she's on a mattress floating on the sea, which then turns into some ship navigating the surface of her unconscious, and she goes below, you know, into the decks of the ship. Captain of the ship looks like John F. Kennedy, and then turns into Roman Castevet, the leader of the ship's destination. Rosemary perceives Roman Castevet as influencing the direction of her life, whilst her protective friend Hutch is banned from boarding the ship due to religious reasons. In the dream, Rosemary is transported on scaffolding through the Sistine Chapel, revealing Michelangelo's Last Judgment paintings on the ceiling. This is a reference to the refurbishments that Rosemary had recently carried out herself in her apartment. You know, all the painting and repairs, the scaffolding that we had seen in those scenes. And we even catch a glimpse of the gingham paper laid out in the closet adjacent to the Castevet's apartment when, you know, the scaffolding runs through this chapel and suddenly you see the kind of gingham paper. The skipper, who looks a lot like the lift operator in Rosemary's apartment building, says, "You better go down below, miss," hinting at some unconscious activity. And below the staircase, sure enough, is, you know, there's a dark basement with burning furnaces and a mattress covered in a rose pattern where Rosemary lies down naked and a group of naked people surrounds her, chanting in Latin. And there's a reference to a mouse bite which relates to the poison mousse Minnie had given Rosemary earlier that night. But, you know, we're told that Minnie calls it mouse. She can't say mousse. So this exercise is sort of applying Freud's method for dream analysis directly to film, trying to deconstruct the film scene and treating the image as a manifest content disguising a repressed message from the unconscious. It's literally going by the book and using Freud's methods in that way. So if we were to situate Rosemary on the hydraulic model, once again, you know, assuming that there's a division between the unconscious and the ego, I suspect that, you know, what Rosemary is trying to suppress is the belief that her husband Guy, or the knowledge rather, that her husband Guy is an actor in profession, but also an actor in marriage, that he's duplicitous and that their love is a sham. This is something she doesn't want to admit to herself, but it's lingering there in her unconscious. If it ever sort of, you know, that desire breaks down the barriers of the threshold of consciousness, quickly the authority agency of the superego, you know, maybe her religious beliefs, perhaps, that might prevent her from separating from her husband. So that might actually prevent the actual expression of the knowledge about her husband. So that's going to get repressed, and then inevitably that energy needs to transfer back onto the conscious awareness, and it returns in the form of paranoid fantasies about plots and conspiracies and thinking that she's going to give birth to a demonic baby. So that's if we assume that all of that was merely just a fantasy. And giving us, you know, a structural model to work with is to understand where that irrational belief comes from. So the third component of the trilogy now, The Tenant, released in 1976, is a screen adaptation of a novel by Roland Topor. It's like a kind of twisted combination of Rear Window and Vertigo by Hitchcock, I think, anyway. And Tchaikovsky, you know, played by Roman Polanski himself, he's a very gentle sort of man, quite reserved, very submissive, quite passive. And he goes and finds this apartment to live in, and the landlord of the building tells him constantly that he wants a quiet and peaceful building. You know, that's the law of the land. He has to respect that no matter what. And the neighbors use extreme tactics to enforce, you know, conforming to that law. And Tchaikovsky becomes convinced, actually, that his neighbors plan to turn him into the suicidal tenant, Simon Schul, who previously occupied his apartment. He's driven insane by his paranoid belief of the conspiracy against him. He has kind of these really bizarre delusions that spiral out of control when Tchaikovsky's identity starts to actually blur with Simon Schul's, resulting in very, very bizarre hallucinations. But once again, you know, we've already established that there was the swinging 60s for Repulsion, the American Dream in New York, you know, in Rosemary's Baby. In The Tenants, we have something that, you know, I think I'd like to qualify, of course it's Paris, but I qualify it as gay Paris, and I'll explain a bit why. You know, Paris is often described as, you know, an opulent city of love, romance, and beauty. Balzac said that, you know, whoever doesn't visit Paris regularly will never really be elegant. And that is a serious crime, I think. And, you know, we have that line from the Cole Porter song in Silk Stockings, you know, Paris loves lovers. And, you know, Nietzsche said that an artist has no home except in Paris. So it's painting this very romantic, idealistic, you know, beautiful picture of elegant Paris, gay Paris, you know, how we've often called it ourselves. But I think that the gay here is actually quite, can be quite convincing in terms of the Tchaikovsky character actually having some sort of repressed homosexuality. He meets an attractive woman called Stella at the hospital where Simon Schul is staying. And they decide to go on a date. And Tchaikovsky, you know, shares a little snog with her at the movie theater. But he abruptly stops when he suddenly becomes aware of a man looking at him in the back row. He increasingly becomes uncomfortable if a woman flirts with him, such as here at the housewarming party in his apartment, where, you know, a very attractive woman is sort of making advances, but he just sort of dismisses her and doesn't really get involved there. At Stella's place one night, she's wearing, you know, she's wearing only a dressing gown, but he's still fully clothed, and he's showing no signs of attraction or excitement towards her at all. And she asks, you know, why don't you take your tie off? You look like you're choking to death. Which that kind of reminded me a bit of something out of Jacques Lacan's theory of obsessional neurosis, where he says that the obsessional neurotic man is a bit like a corpse, you know, who's just lying there, doesn't do anything, you know, is afraid of committing any sort of act, and just goes through life like that all the time. Very sort of similar picture to what's going on there. And also, you know, Tchaikovsky, he's convinced that his neighbors bully and taunt a disabled child in the building, even making her wear a jester's costume with a Tchaikovsky mask placed on her face. And this could be a sign of his own paranoia about being targeted by others on account of his sexual orientation. Now, what, I mean, it's kind of like maybe... It sounds a bit out there, like, why is he repressed as a homosexual? But I'm quite convinced that there's something there, because there's a, and this is the scene that for me revealed what I think might be going on. Tchaikovsky meets a man, called Georges Badard, who reacts very strongly at the news of Simon Schul's death. You know, he comes to visit the apartment, which now Tchaikovsky is occupying, used to be Simon's. And apparently, he had no idea that, you know, she'd had this accident falling out of the window. And then he reveals to Tchaikovsky that he'd secretly loved Simon, declaring, you know, very beautiful here, years of affection without ever daring to say anything. I acted as though we were just friends each time I saw her. It just isn't fair. The day I summon up enough courage to tell her, I find out she's dead. Why? Why didn't I ever tell her? She's gone without ever knowing it. Life isn't worth living anymore. So he expresses this kind of, you know, suicidal ideation, so concerned about losing this great love, you know, this unrequited love. So Tchaikovsky consoles Georges and prevents him from, you know, taking his own life by spending the whole evening with him, talking through the night and consoling him, being there for him. And at dawn, they arrive at the metro station and Georges tells Tchaikovsky, "What you've done for me is not natural. There aren't many guys around like you. It's as simple as this. You saved my life." And then he plants this massive kiss on the lips, you know, which is kind of out of the blue. And then we see Georges, you know, going down the metro steps. And the camera is fixated on his descent into the underground space. And this can be kind of interpreted as Tchaikovsky's sudden, you know, admission of homosexual desire, perhaps. Or at least, you know, some sort of attraction for this man, Georges. And I think, you know, it's sort of interesting to see him quickly, you know, sort of being confronted with this desire and then quickly repressing it, the attraction, as he disappears down the staircase. The unrequited love, the regrets, you know, held at not expressing affection for someone, is not on the part of is actually on the part of Tchaikovsky, not Georges for Simon. And there's another clue as well. Earlier on in the evening, they had gone to this sort of bar where they were going to just get a couple of drinks, and a drunken man stumbles in and announces that he's going to buy a round for everyone in the bar. But then he just kind of singles out Georges and says, "But not you, not for the likes of you. I don't like you." And, you know, this kind of very targeted, you know, slur against this person. So it just slightly made me think that maybe there is some repression going on there. And there's a sub theme in The Tenant centered around Egyptology. There's several scenes in the film that refer to the mysteries surrounding ancient Egypt. And I think for this reason alone, Freud would have been interested in The Tenant, given that he was a great lover of archaeology and antiquity, and we have that evidence just downstairs. Like for instance, Simon's injured body in the hospital becomes a symbol for repression itself, with secret wounds tightly wrapped and hidden from view, like an Egyptian mummy. And Tchaikovsky's identification with Simon suggests that he's covering up something as well. One of Simon's friends gives Tchaikovsky a book she used to own called The Novel of the Mummy, Le Roman de la Mummy, continuing the theme of Egypt, Egyptology. A postcard arrives from Georges Badar, and it's addressed to Simon, but gets handed to Tchaikovsky. And on it is an Egyptian figure representing the preservation of the dead and immortality, terms one might use to describe the eternal recurrence of desires emanating from the unconscious, you know, the undying aspect of desires. And there's also a shared bathroom on Tchaikovsky's apartment floor where neighbors apparently stand dead still for hours reading and writing Egyptian hieroglyphics on the wall, building on the increasingly bizarre references to Egyptology, but certainly, you know, continuing to convey that mystery, that there's some code that needs to be deciphered, that something's being hidden from view, and whatever it is, it's eternal, it goes on forever. So Tchaikovsky's denial about his sexual orientation, I think, catalyzes a full-blown gender identity disorder where he begins to assume the physical qualities of the deceased Simon Schul through transvestism, even imagining that his neighbors have conspired to make him smoke the same brand of cigarettes as Simon used to buy. And in a philosophical moment, he asks someone, you know, at what precise moment does an individual stop being who he thinks he is? If you cut off my head, what would I say? Me in my head or me in my body? What right has my head to call itself me? So he's got very philosophical there, but it's something to do with his, you know, unconscious awareness that he's transforming. He's in the process of, you know, losing his identity, as it were, or his identity that he's willing to admit to himself is not the real one. It's also interesting because Simon, again playing with the names here, Simon is a name derived from Hebrew, Simeon, which means one who hears. And this is relevant in the building where Tchaikovsky lives, where the neighbors are obsessed with overhearing noise and enforcing quiet. And Schul, in French, is a traditional team ball game from Normandy, played wherever crowds of people met, often very violent and aggressive. And it's significant in this still here, in the final still, where Tchaikovsky imagines that his neighbors are in the courtyard playing football with his decapitated head. So it's this sort of, you know, again, very clever play on words and names. So I'm just going to show you a clip from The Tenant, and you'll get to see for yourself just what a fuss the neighbors make about noise. It's actually quite comical, I think.
Upstairs, and I can hear every word you're saying. You've been dragging furniture. furniture around, stabbing about all over the place. It's intolerable. Can you carry on like this much longer?
Who is that asshole? Sorry, but I will be more careful on that one.
You don't seem to give a damn about anyone else. It's all very well to have a good time, but some people have to work, you know?
Tomorrow, Sunday, is quite reasonable for the people around on Saturday evening.
No, it's not reasonable to make such a racket even on a Saturday evening!
Thank you. Richard's tipsy tenor, or singing La Tosca at 3 a.m. Louis Mara, age 39, a bachelor traveling salesman, came home at 3 in the morning after wandering too many, and proceeded to sing hop with his windows wide open. When a neighbor, Monsieur Pirro, expressed a wish to put off his warbling, until somewhat later, Monsieur Mara promptly illustrated his contempt for such a suggestion with an air from Tosca delivered on the hall landing. Monsieur Pirro reappeared with a gun and emptied it into the poor tenor, who died before he had been to the hospital. The murderer is under arrest.
You there? Why now? How much longer are you going to keep up this racket?
You can see that the tenant it's quite disturbing in terms of subject matter, but it can be quite comical as well, in many respects. But just some observations now, from that clip. So at the beginning of the scene, one of the party guests makes an offensive, completely unacceptable and disrespectful slur about women's lib supporters being unattractive and enough to turn a man queer. And this, you know, creates a great impression on Trotsky. He perceives this language as threatening, a factor contributing perhaps to his own repression of his homosexuality. Trotsky's neighbor objects to the housewarming party, complaining about the loud noise. His friend soon says, you won't even be able to jerk off without him knocking on the door, suggesting that the neighbor's interference will be having an effect on Trotsky's sex life. Trotsky obeys his angry neighbor, and the neighbor is very much a representation, of the superego being appeased. And Trotsky asks his guests to leave the apartment, ending the party. And we see the noisy guests emerging from the apartment, stepping down the building's large staircase. And this image, is a lot like this, reminded me so much of like desires being pushed down into the realm of the unconscious, out of sight, out of mind, the ego thinks, but not really. Then Trotsky's interaction with his landlord the next day is very strained, as he apologizes profusely about the party, and then we see him carrying all this rubbish bags, some bits of the garbage falling out while he speaks sheepishly with the landlord. Again, a symbol of the repressed threatening to return, this garbage that he's, that's busting out of the bags, that he's desperate to throw away, desperate to cover up. And as he walks, first we see the landlord walking down, after he's made his threat about the apartment, we see him walking down the stairwell. This can be an image of the superego being internalized. All that garbage falls down the stairwell when Trotsky goes downstairs, but when he comes back up, it's gone. So that made me think that it was a hallucination. It didn't really happen. It's just his overwhelming desire reaching the surface. And then finally, the sort of, the playfulness of his friends at work, teasing him about a neighbor being shot because he made too much noise, just sort of playing into Trotsky's fear there. So if you try to place him on the hydraulic model, once again with the partitions as we've seen before, if we go with the theory that, the unconscious wish for Trotsky is the attraction to the shy academic Georges Badard, and maybe the desire to cross-dress, if that, breaks down the barrier of the threshold of awareness and Trotsky becomes aware of that desire, he might be met with the, super ego function, the overbearing landlord, his neighbors, setting strict standards for appropriate behavior, what's allowed, what's not allowed, and he might, in the end, suppress that desire. But again, the energy from that desire is not just simply going to vanish forever. It will have to return. And in this case, it seems to be emerging in the form of blurring you know, blurrings of gender identity, delusions of reference, thinking that people are talking about you when maybe they're really not, suicidal ideation, he copies Simone's behavior, and derealization. So just in my concluding remarks, I would like to point out that at the heart of the apartment trilogy, there is a fundamental constant where we see the central character in each installment screaming through a climax of madness at some point in the film. And yet they're surrounded by idle spectators. The horror is not just of going mad, but being witnessed by a group of familiar people who know you, but who do nothing to help you. They simply stand there and watch the madness unfold, almost as entertainment for themselves. So we see that happening here in Repulsion, where Carol, you know, when this is the scene where she fears that she's being raped, you know, and she lets out this terrible silent scream. In fact, Polanski doesn't, you know, he keeps it quite silent, but we can sense that she's screaming. And at the very end, she has a massive nervous breakdown, and yet all the neighbors, you know, the nosy neighbors from the apartment block, gather into her room, watch her having a nervous breakdown, even her with her sister standing there, and no one is really doing anything, you know, to help her, except for maybe Michael. Michael's the only one who goes towards her, carries her out of the flat. Perhaps on some level, satisfying that unconscious, you know, fairy tale that maybe she wanted to repress about Michael, that she's in the end in his arms being carried out of the flat. But that's neither here nor there for this point. We have the scream followed by the idle spectators. In Rosemary's Baby, that's the same thing does happen. You know, when Rosemary's convinced that she's given birth to a demonic baby, she lets out, you know, a violent scream, and yet she's in an apartment full of people who look very Stepfordish. Like, they're not even, you know, they're not reacting to her in a normal way. They're not trying to help her. They offer her a cup of tea, for God's sakes. Like, it's just, you know, it's not the right thing to be offering in at a time like this. But it's, you know, it's just kind of this extremely incongruous reaction to quite a, you know, a heartfelt emotional disturbance. And yet the same thing again happens in The Tenant. Tchaikovsky finds himself in the hospital after he tries to commit suicide, lets out a horrific animalistic scream, and he screams many times also in front of his neighbors, but once again they're all kind of congregating together, watching him as in his display of madness, not really doing anything to help him. It's almost like a sheer form of entertainment. And for those of you who've seen The Tenant, there is actually a scene right at the very end where Tchaikovsky thinks that his apartment block has turned into some sort of opera house or a theater, and all of his neighbors are there and they're watching him commit this spectacle of jumping out the window. So it's very much got that sort of theatrical, mad feeling. And all of this kind of reminded me of Black Swan, which is a film that I really like. My colleagues at the BFI make fun of me for liking it because they're very, like, highbrow. But I really like Black Swan. I thought it was very well executed. But what I think this has in common with the apartment trilogy, and Darren Aronofsky, the director of Black Swan, he said openly that he's been, you know, influenced by Roman Polanski. I find what this really has in common is that very fundamental motif of the scream. In this case, I mean, that's still up there, looks so much like Edvard Munch's Scream, you know, where she, you know, there's a sort of build up to her breakdown, and then in that scene she completely loses the plot, sees things that are not there, and has that scream. And then ultimately she thinks she's turning into an actual swan, and she delivers a fantastic performance, and the audience is there, and they're none the wiser about her breakdown. They're just having a good time. They're being entertained. So this just had that kind of same feeling of depersonalizing, you know, what's going on in someone else's life. But there are so many other similarities between Black Swan and these films. For instance, especially Repulsion, I've captured these kind of stills to show you. The bathtub scene where we see Colin, you know, being injured, and Carol putting him in the bathtub, and there's blood in there. It reminded me of the Natalie Portman scene where she is in the bathtub and she puts her head under the water. The cracks forming in the house where Carol lives, she starts to hallucinate cracks forming on the walls. and everything sort of, you know, being in ruin around her. And that same motif, visual system, is employed by Darren Aronofsky in the marketing for Black Swan, where we see Natalie Portman as a sort of porcelain doll with like a massive crack on her face, suggesting mental breakdown. But the most iconic one for me is the whole fingernail hang. And for those of you who've seen Black Swan, I can see you nodding. You remember this scene very well. Obviously, Carol, you know, playing around with, or at least in her profession, having to deal with cuticles with her clients, and then the Natalie Portman character with the hang nail. So I won't leave that on there too much longer. It's not a very pleasant picture. But then taking it again into the whole trilogy, bringing it back to the trilogy, there's, you know, the apartment motif, someone going mad in an apartment, such a huge component of Black Swan when we see her coming, you know, walking around in the corridors. There's mirrors everywhere in Black Swan, and it's constantly capturing her reflection. And in a way, I compare that to the image, the iconic image of Repulsion with the hands coming out. It's not so much, she's not so worried about, you know, molesting hands as she is about her own image being a destructive force in her own world. And I mean, that's quite striking, the similarity there between, you know, that shot in Rosemary's Baby when Guy turns into some sort of Satan, you know, devilish character, and his eyes are red, and we see Natalie Portman's eyes going red when she's transforming, when she thinks she's transforming into a swan. And finally, you know, in The Tenant, once again, Tchaikovsky in full drag here, threatening to jump out the window, very much as a performance. He imagines his neighbors are gathered around him as spectators. And yes, of course, you know, he does in the end jump down and injures himself. And Natalie Portman, the same thing happens. She's in front of a big audience, giving a big performance in complete costume. And once again, it's just, you know, it's actually a quite a horrific situation where no one can help her. She's going to self-destruct. So that concludes really my lecture, but I wanted to open it up to a discussion and talk to everyone and just find out really what people think. And I'm sure you have maybe some questions. If so, that would be great. But if not, I have a few points here that might whet your appetite in terms of having some topics that we can talk about. For instance, what do people signify in the apartment trilogy? For those of you who've seen the three films, there's so many moments where someone looks through the door and like sees, you know, the distorted image of someone standing there. In what way does the apartment motif continue to be useful in Polanski's film Carnage, one of his later films, more recent films, with, I think, Jodie Foster it was, and Kate Winslet? What are some other examples of apartment-based psychological thrillers that you can think of? And also, as we proceed with the question time, I'll just hand around the evaluation form with some pens if you don't have it, and it'd be great to capture your feedback as well as a listener. And if you have, you know, if you want to stay abreast of more topics, you know, more events like this, you can follow me on Twitter, and I usually just use that account for publicizing more events. So that's it from me. Thank you very much. Do you have any questions or comments at all, or? As you think of some things, I'll just pass around some sheets. And if you could, it'd be great to have, if you could just leave the sheets on the seats on your way out. That way I'll be sure to collect the information from you. Mm-hmm. That's all right. Thank you very much. Do you have any comments or?
Yes, could I just say, I wonder if Roman Polanski.
Yeah.
Realize that John Cassavetes anagram of Castaway.
Yeah.
You must go, oh my god, I've got the devil acting.
That's such a good observation. I thought of that as well. And the first time I heard the word Castavet in the film Rosemary's Baby, I thought they actually said Cassavetes. And I thought, is he playing himself in the film? I hope not. Like, that would be a terrible thing. But yeah, that's a good observation. Very good observation. It was the same year that Rosemary's Baby was released. So, just after. So, and that's a very uncanny set of circumstances anyway, because obviously she was pregnant. I think 8.5 months pregnant. She was 8.5 months pregnant with their baby, their first baby, and it was obviously under very bizarre circumstances with the Manson family. And people were quite dubious because they'd seen this film and there's all these references to, abusing pregnant ladies and all these sorts of stuff. He was actually, for a brief time, some sort of suspect, if not formally a suspect of what happened to Sharon Tate. They did question him. And also it was all just the circumstances of filming, Rosemary's Baby were also fodder for a tabloid because Mia Farrow, who I believe at the time was married to Frank Sinatra, they split up, I think, on the set of the film because he didn't want her to get involved in the film. And it ended up being a great thing for her career. But it's a very bizarre set of circumstances.
I think Sharon Tate was actually Polanski's first choice for playing Rosemary, but then Mia Farrow, the studio wanted Mia Farrow to have it.
That's right.
And actually there was a sort of significant media campaign against Polanski using sort of footage from Fearless Vampire Killers.
Oh yes.
Yeah. And they were sort of suggesting that it was actually Sharon's fault because she'd supposedly been involved in these occult rituals, but actually it would turn out to be footage. But just on that, I think something that's quite interesting about the three films is that I think the first two are so sensitively concerned with sort of quite feminist concerns, like the sort of opening of Repulsion, for example, the fact that she's constantly got this unwanted attention, and then Rosemary's Baby is, quite significantly concerned with reproductive rights, but also there's this rape at the beginning that's the repressed thing. And then I just think it's interesting that in the Tenant he sort of deliberately puts himself in that position, and I just wondered what you think about the relation to Sharon Tate's death, and sort of, the idea that maybe Polanski's trying to inhabit that kind of position. He's really experimenting with gender in that one.
He really is. And that's such an insightful comment about linking those films together through feminism and the feminine presence in the films. I think that it is very interesting. I think you are onto something, because in The Tenant, when Roman Polanski's character, Tchaikovsky, is in full drag, one of the first things he says, once the whole costume is complete and he looks in the mirror, he says, "I think I'm pregnant," which is very striking because it's kind of like quite comical in a way, because it's quite hammy the way he says it. But at the same time, I think that it's sort of self-referential. He's going back to personal events that he's lived through. When we know that this character is, the character he's embodying in the film, has a very bad thing, emerging in the narrative in terms of being suicidal. So we know that they're disturbed and unhinged, and yet, there's that reference to pregnancy, and I think putting himself in the female role, but also I think because of the whole business of what happened with the youngster that he was with as well, that all I think touches on his experience as a filmmaker representing the feminine. I think he was quite aware of how very attractive women were treated by men, and also were treated by him as well. There's a really interesting interview. I think it's in, I'm not sure which of the films it's on, but it's an extra, in, a special feature in one of the three films on the DVD. And he talks with a British journalist about that situation with a young girl and about Sharon Tate. And some of the things that he actually says, I mean, he's not a saint, you know, he is quite a controversial man, and some of the things that he says are, let's say, not very respectful of women. And yet, at the same time, he's capable of making these films, which are very reflective, which are very introspective and thought-provoking. They're not, I don't think they're shallow films in any means. So I always try to reconcile that with him. I can't quite work out if he's trying to just be controversial in order to raise his profile, or whether he just genuinely believes these things that he says and actions that he does. I think part of me feels like maybe he can't help himself. He's a bit of a, he might just be a bit of a chauvinist. I hope that's not the case. But what do you think? How do you reconcile that?
I don't know. I mean, I guess if you take sort of strictly psychoanalytic analysis of the first two films, then you might be in danger of like ignoring the sort of, I don't know, like if you say that they're an entire fantasy, for example, you might sort of miss some of the sort of literal language of film. Like I think in Rosemary's Baby, the kind of, how kind of she's sort of in a series of different wounds, and she's kind of, it's totally, she's abused with the complicity of her neighbours who kind of stand in for the family. So maybe it's more kind of Lacanian. But then, I don't know, I guess like the work is separate from the man and like the obvious connections. But I think, I think Repulsion and Rosemary's Baby is certainly like strongly feminist films.
I think you are right. I think there is, in the third film, maybe he's trying to reconcile, or at least somehow embody the experience of being a woman by playing the part of a man whose gender identity is blurred with the one of a woman. So I think it's definitely thought-provoking. Yes? You're both in my line of vision.
He's okay. First of all, I was going to say, because you were looking at the conflicts in Polanski's personality, have you read any of the popular philosopher psychology writer Adam Finn? Because he wrote a book called Going Sane as a chapter on sexuality, and he was saying that sexuality is never politically correct.
Oh, right.
And I thought that was quite well put, but he writes about that really well.
Sure.
I just wanted to know, because I don't read too much gossip. I don't know much about Polanski's life, but the word crossovers, and I'm sorry, but probably everybody here knows them, but I don't. Things that happened in his life sort of crossed over with his films, because I don't know about them, actually.
Well, basically, in a nutshell, his wife Sharon, who was an actress in one of his films previously, was pregnant, eight and a half months pregnant with his their first child. And she was brutally murdered by the Manson family in California. But he wasn't in town. I think he might have been in London or somewhere. And I think he did actually harbor a great deal of guilt about that, for not being around when that happened. Of course, I don't think he might have been able to prevent it. But just those kinds of horrific things that happened. And it's worth... I'll definitely check out the... sexuality is not politically correct. Is that
just a book called Going Sane?
Sure, Going Sane.
He writes about how there's a popular belief that artists are usually a bit bonkers, and he sort of dissects that and says that actually we do our best work when we're most sane and things like that. And he sort of starts to talk about these things of being actually more health as a healthy sort of normal part of being human. So.
Interesting. Thank you. Yes. You had a question.
I was going to pick up on the same thing about Polanski's life and his films.
Yeah.
It would seem to me from Repulsion that, my reading of it is that she may have been abused as a child by her father.
Yeah.
And that's what that sequence is with the photograph. And she's looking daggers at him. So it seems to me that Polanski's very aware of the damage that child abuse caused, very aware. Yet, I don't know much about that case with the young child, the young girl. I think she was 13.
14.
But I think she was drugged at too, and I think that there's a really scary kind of art life imitation thing going on there, which makes me feel incredibly uncomfortable, but I don't quite know how to reconcile that.
Sure.
The other thing I wanted to say about motifs and similarities with other films, I really love the film Possession, and particularly the part where you don't normally see the monster, do you?
Yeah.
So I guess in Rosemary's Baby you do, and in Possession you do.
Mm.
In Possession it's almost like a protective monster, which is, I think, really interesting. So maybe she did another talk if she
Oh, fantastic. I own a copy of Possession, and I've been toying with the idea of situating that title within a lecture.
Because I feel like Possession is another example of a film where the horror could be reality, or it's just an unfurling of this psychological reaction that someone's having to their real situation that they're uncomfortable with.
Sure.
And their oppression.
And there's a kind of political aspect too.
That's
and
right.
I think Possession is also based in Eastern Europe. That's interesting.
That's very interesting.
That's really
fantastic.
Something that I picked up on is the kind of ideas around what is sane and what is not sane.
Sure.
I feel like with the what's it called? This the hot peeper through the door.
Yes.
It kind of exaggerates your feeling that you're in the mind of the protagonist, and that everyone else around you is kind of against you, almost like it's a conspiracy. But also, it feels like you're going mad. The protagonist is mad, but everyone else understands the rules of society apart from you.
Yes.
And that's what that helps kind of emphasize.
That's exactly how I felt when I saw those scenes of people being, you know, looked at through the peephole. That sort of amplified, over-exaggerated dimension of the face, the isolation that you feel as well, especially when it's a stranger as well. Certainly in Repulsion, when she keeps looking through the peephole and she sees a neighbor that she never talks to. It's incredibly, it has a weird function of the practical function of finding out who's there, whilst at the same time magnifying, over-amplifying the presence of that person in your own mind. If you're already a little bit, vulnerable psychologically, then that can, it might be able to contribute to further damage that's been there.
Something I noticed in all of them was the kind of presence of a female neighbour.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if that could be seen as a maternal figure. There always seems to be that female neighbour at the periphery who may be the superego authority, repressing homosexuality, repressing divorce.
Yeah. I think that's a good observation, because certainly even at the beginning, certainly in Rosemary's Baby, when we see the female neighbor, I certainly did when I first watched Rosemary's Baby, not knowing what it was going to be about. I thought, oh, that's really helpful, you know, neighbors helping each other out, especially the lady, Mrs. Kastovit, bringing, whatever it was that she first brought over as a gift, and then eventually it turned out that she had some, less than benevolent intentions towards Rosemary. But yes, there's that sort of initial instinct to relate to the female neighbor as a protective, nurturing force. I mean, let's say if Carol wasn't so repressed, she might see her elderly neighbor as, a mother figure, her and her sister living in London on their own, away from their family in Belgium. They might have struck up, let's say, a bond with the neighbor. But the fact that they're so, she's so incredibly at a distance from her neighbors, we quickly see that actually she's holding a lot of, she's very vulnerable. And in The Tenant as well, I think that the female neighbors there at first seem really nice, friendly, and then we immediately see that they have their own agenda, and whether or not it's the fact that they are nosy and disruptive. It's not sure. I'm never sure watching The Tenant whether it's all in his head, or because there are scenes where they just kind of look at each other like, what's wrong with this guy? Like, we're not doing anything wrong, and yet we then see him, reacting and It's a very, very well executed exercise in demonstrating paranoia in all three films, and I think also in Black Swan. Black Swan is a very good example of paranoia.
I like the idea of the mother figure of at first being maternal and then becoming poisonous.
Yeah.
Like in Rosemary's Baby, she is perhaps being a comforting or presence, the neighbour. And she's bringing this milk-like substance in the smoothie that's actually poisonous. Mm. It kind of reminds me of like ideas in psychoanalysis around the severance of the breast and weaning and the like neurosis that builds from that stage.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
What about the absence of the family?
Yeah.
So could be the family, the neighbors replace the family as a traditional way of showing this kind of relationship in the film. I think it's quite relevant. All of them
has
an absence of family. In Repulsion, the sister is not really a sister. Mm. It's more like a flatmate. Mm. She's in a relationship. And maybe also the object of desire is related to be the sister, the girl, the person.
Yes.
You know, the personality is not like a sister, or just a object of desire.
Object A, yes. Yeah. And actually, funnily enough, in Repulsion, it's her boss at the beauty parlor, who's very maternal towards her, asking if she's okay, you know, asking if she's been looking after herself. So she gives a far more nurturing, set of actions towards towards Carol. And I think also Colin's quite protective of her. But yes, it's true. We see the family dynamic be projected onto characters, whether they're related to each other or not. There's the family dynamic emerging very much in these films. There was a hand up there,
Yes, I was just wondering, do you think that the difference between the Thorgrim and the Black Boy has an effect on the way that the audience perceives the effect of psychosis?
In psychosis? That's a good question. I think there's elements where black and white delivers a stronger feeling of psychosis. Especially in, I think Repulsion is a very good example of that. It certainly had a mass, it was very effective as a psychological thriller when it first came out, because all the people that I know who saw it at the time, you know, they're a little bit older than me, but they told me that that's the film that, you know, really struck them as being very, very frightening, and it seemed to have a very strong effect. And I don't know if that's because it was one in a series of black and white films being released in the mid-60s, maybe amongst so many new French New Wave films and Italian films. Those are very different to this, because this is so stark and it's very unforgiving in terms of you know, the imagery, and it's some of it is still very subtle, but a lot of it is very brutal as well. But I think that I do think that in Rosemary's Baby, obviously being in color, as I said earlier, it's very hammy, and yet at the same time, it is very unsettling as well. The scenes with the sort of, you know, like the satanic rituals and stuff, I find those quite, well, I think they're quite lighthearted. It's her reaction, you know, the way that she reacts, Mia Farrow, her big eyes, and she really acts from the heart, and you see her expressive face, and you can see that she's very vulnerable, she's very worried on whether she's not sure whether she's going mad or whether these things are really happening to her. I think that performance, transcends, you know, elements like in filmmaking like color and photography. And I think that the strength in The Tenant relies very much in the dialogue. Because it's less breathtaking, if you will, as Repulsion and Rosemary's Baby, but it's very cleverly made. I think it's probably the closest in terms of psychoanalysis, in terms of the way it's formulated. Yeah.
Just wondering if you thought about bringing in what Freud actually argues on the nature into this. This is quite an initial, you know, his famous statement on love thy neighbor being the most horrific, and anger becomes so horrifying. So So do you think, I mean, yes, I know you have this reading of the neighbours, the symbol, the superego, but is it not also about the horror of the relationship with the other as well, this kind of ambivalence and aggressivity that Freud talks about in relation to...
Yeah, and the sort of what Sarge said also about hell being other people as well, this sort of... the very benign area, the very sort of ambivalent area of, that's a very good point actually, because in a way it is the horror of the person living next to you who doesn't have your best interest in mind and who is actually out to get you in some way, out to be your aggressor, your nemesis. And yet you're sharing the same space and there's no real connection there ever. And I think actually for me, the way that that translates the problematic relationship with the neighbor, I think for me how I reconcile that is in the Lacanian model of alienation within language, the fact that we actually all speak the same, let's say, language, we all speak English together, and there's this sort of false reassurance that because we speak the same language, we understand each other. But actually, language is destined to fail as a system of communication because we all have different identifications and associations with each word that we use. Every single word that we use is loaded with spiritual significance, emotional significance, intellectual significance, and there may be crossover when we're talking to someone else, but there probably isn't any crossover, and we're actually never communicating through language. It's a very unsophisticated mode of communication, and that's how I reconcile it in relation to the neighbor. And also, it also reminds me of Freud's, is it the dream of the broken kettle with... where his neighbor returned the kettle, but it wasn't broken when he lent it, but it shows up broken, and he's like, well, what happened here? And there's a list of reasons why it went wrong, and he realizes the neighbor is lying because there's too many reasons. There's not just a straightforward answer. So it's that deception once again, and being wary of your neighbor. And certainly Freud, you know, as a scientist, his contemporaries, his intellectual neighbors, were horrible to him. You know, they were very ungracious. Well, maybe not all of them, but certainly the majority of them. And he felt ostracized as a scientist. So he probably, with good reason, had suspicion.
His neighbors were Nazis.
His neighbors were Nazis. That's a very, yes, that's true. Interesting.
There is definitely an element of repulsion in all, a repression in all the films. But I wonder if there is also a kind of sense of very strong narcissism in all the characters, because they seem to be so closed in a sense that they don't want actually to let anything slip out, and especially in the Repulsion and Rosemary.
Yeah.
While in The Tenant, it seems that he actually wants to find a way to be himself, and in a sense, because he cannot be the way he would like to, in a sense, he gives in to what he imagines is the pressure of turning into Simone. And so it can be that there is an element of homosexuality, but I think that there is also a very strong element of narcissism there.
Absolutely. Being so self-absorbed that you think that everything is a delusion of reference. Everyone is talking about you. You're the center of everyone's universe. And the plot that exists, you know, thank you. Those people's lives are, you know, they're consumed with plotting against you. That's a very good turnaround of flipping it on its head and showing that that's also a very relevant reading of the films. That, and in fact, Black Swan is the same thing there. You know, it's not enough that all these dancers have a show to do, and there's a whole production going on, and it's very complicated. You know, Natalie Portman is having a crisis, you know, and it's very self-absorbed. Yeah, I think that's a good alternative to what might be going on, for sure.
It's like it's a self-imposed prison at times. It's protecting them from expressing their true desires. So like with the tenant, he moves into a building where he can't have sex because people will hear, so therefore he doesn't have to have sex with them.
It's a good enough excuse
to
move into that building, which provides him with a set of circumstances that means that he's destined not to be able to do the very thing that he wants to do. It's a very good defense mechanism to ward off having to have the anxiety of decide whether or not to invite someone back. Yeah.
I was going to, I don't know Rosemary's Baby as well or The Tenant, but I saw Repulsion before coming here.
Yeah.
That was beautiful. I'm affected by it today, not just the people who saw it at the time.
Yeah.
But, you know, I read it as in a very different way. There have already been a couple of comments to that effect, that I don't see it as, say, narcissism or repression. I see it as a very traumatized woman who's dissociated, split off, terrible, terrible, terrifying things. I'm thinking of her as someone having been molested.
Sure.
Who's, you know, staring at the molestor, potentially the perpetrator in the picture, you know?
Sure.
And who has, and who's undergoing a complete psychotic decompensation because of this this traumatization and this dissociation, splitting off, you know, all of these terrible memories. But I don't see her necessarily as somebody who's narcissistic or repressing the sexual urges. I see her very differently. I see from a trauma perspective.
From a trauma perspective, sure. And I think that the beauty of Polanski's films is that there's enough room for varying associations, varying interpretation to take place, and I think that actually is a very good sign of an artist. And I think that David Lynch does that very well. He creates an ambiguous enough universe that different spectators can, you know, take in different interpretations. Yeah, they're good projective tests.
If I could just say just one thing.
Yeah.
I was very interested in the Faustian pact element of Rosemary's Baby.
Yeah.
It's very powerful.
Yeah, absolutely. Because Guy only met the couple one time.
Yeah.
And straight away, you know, he was making a deal. And I think that is probably a reflection of just how perverse his desire to progress is, you know, that he's willing in one session to trade in his, you know, his wife for the promise of a scintillating, you know, career as an actor.
And his competitor goes blunt. He still doesn't care.
No, he doesn't at all. He doesn't at all. Exactly, yeah.
Was the woman called Minnie?
Yes.
That woman.
Yeah.
And there's a mouse, and it's Minnie Mouse.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Like, he's making a dig at Disney as well.
That's very clever. Yeah. I hadn't thought of Minnie Mouse, actually. It's very good.
Capitalism.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Very good, clever dig. Yeah, yeah. Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you
very, very much indeed, and thank you to everyone actually for such a really, such great quality and depth to the questions.
I
sense that, you know, we could easily have and enjoy a sort of a half day of this conversations afterwards, just expanding more and more. And maybe if I could just add, because about the Freud connections, to me seems to be so, so strong.
Mm-hmm.
And I was reminded very often, been reading recently, Hilda Doolittle's HD's tribute to Freud, and it comes up, you know, she recognises that gardenia as her favourite flower over, so Mrs. Gardenia.
Mrs. Gardenia.
Her dream is a hieroglyph, and that each day she's coming up and, you know, peeping through the keyhole into the waiting to get into the apartment.
Wow.
Who's come out, who's coming in. And the neighbours that we talked about, the Nazis, so she talks about the swastikas on the road and becoming more and more oppressive. So she then comes in 38 and visits him here in his last year's life. I don't know. And it just came out in the 60s. It was only just published in the 60s, if I remember this. But there seemed to be an awful lot of that. And that she is she's located in London and in Paris and in America, and she's American. So, but it's great for us. I'm glad
Fantastic. This is your spiritual home.
Oh. You're very welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Marian. And I hope, just to remind you again, that the next talk will be on, and I've lost my...
Theron.
It's the
15th of May.
15th.
Yeah, that's all right. That's okay. On Theron. Yeah, and you can catch it at the BFI. Thank you so much, Don, for that lovely.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And if you could just also leave your evaluation forms, I'm dying to read your comments. Thank you so much.